Welcome to Gima's Tales for Children. Each week, we visit a different part of the world to hear stories, legends, and myths. Some of these stories are so old that the origin has been lost in time. Some are new, and some are timeless. Join us as we travel this week to Polynesia. Polynesia is a group of scattered islands in the vast southern part of the Pacific Ocean between Asia and South America. Around 2000 BC, families made long, dangerous journeys to settle there. The settlers arrived with pigs, dogs, and hens. They built thatched wooden houses, gathered bananas, coconuts, and breadfruit, and fished. The settlers' ancestors came from Southeast Asia and had lived there for at least 30,000 years. Slowly they moved to islands in the Pacific. By 1200 BC, they reached Tonga and Samoa on the western edge of Polynesia. Most of these islands are volcanic. Over thousands of years, vast coral reefs have grown up around these islands and today are a great attraction for tourists, as well as the people of these islands who hunt for their food in the ocean. For further information about Polynesia for children, I suggest www.factmonster.com. Our first story is about an octopus named Horby, who lived in one of the lagoons surrounding a beautiful island in the middle of Polynesia. He escapes death and finds a new home in The Octopus Palace by E.G. French. Horby the octopus really liked to collect things, especially bright and shiny things. Horby reminded himself that it was only a matter of time before his small cave would be so full he wouldn't be able to fit his little body in it. Bang, bang, bang! The noise so startled Horby that six of his tentacles grabbed onto the rocks above him. Bang, bang, bang! What a noisy place this was turning out to be. He saw Uncle Valini in front of him, all brown with big purple spots. Get out now, nephew, said his uncle. I'm moving in, and there's not room for two.
But, Uncle, this is my house, not yours, cried Horby.
His uncle only grinned and replied, Well, then, get ready, 'cause you're in for a noisy, rough time of it. Well, it hasn't been the greatest of homes, thought Horby. It was so close to the shore that sometimes when the tide fell, there wasn't enough water to swim in, and he had to leave it. Swimming into deeper waters was always dangerous for an octopus. There were big fish and eels, not to mention there was nowhere to hide and wait for the unwary little fish to swim by for your dinner. Okay, Uncle Valini, I'll leave now. His uncle grinned again. He was truly a very lazy octopus. He loved stealing his relatives' caves after they had fixed them up, and then when he had made a mess, he'd just move on. Horby thought of the special treasures he had collected so carefully. I'd better search for another cave that absolutely no one in my family can ever find, and I'm not going to tell anyone about it, ever. Then he lowered his little head and muttered, Fine, take it. It wasn't that great anyway. Horby looked up worriedly at his lazy uncle. He didn't want Uncle Valini to know how much he valued his little collection.
But first, would you mind if I moved my stuff out?
Sure, kid, said his uncle with a sly smile. Just don't take too much time.
Poor Horby, what was he to do? His uncle was just waiting for him to leave. How could he possibly pull everything out of his little cave, and where would he put it all? Suddenly, Horby had a clever thought. After all, octopi are very intelligent creatures. Okay, Uncle Valini, but I was hoping to go to the big crab festival today. You know, the one where they all get together to travel out to sea.
Well, Uncle Valini hadn't heard about any such festival, but being an octopus, crab was one of his favorite treats.
You serious, kid? He asked. I didn't hear about that festival, but it sounds downright delicious.
He became so excited at the prospect of fresh crab that his spots grew so much they looked like big, round, purple sea urchins.
Well, either go to the festival and I'll move in right now, or you can get your stuff out while I go get my fill of fresh crab. It's no matter to me.
Truthfully, he was hoping Horby would pick the latter, because that would be one less octopus to compete for such a delicacy.
Oh, thank you, Uncle Bellini, thank you, cried Horby. You go to the festival and I'll pack up my stuff. I'll be out of here before you get back. He was delighted that his ruse had worked. He waited for his uncle to leave. Uncle Bellini started to swim away, but then suddenly looked back. Hey, kid, which way is this festival? He asked. Horby thought quickly. Just on the other side of the lagoon, he said, and pointed one little tentacle in the direction of the farthest place he could remember. Thanks, kid, said Uncle Bellini. Just be sure you're gone when I get back. With a quick explosion of water through his gills, he raced away to the festival. Horby didn't think too much about how angry his uncle would be when he discovered the crabs didn't exist. He focused on what little time he had to move his precious shiny objects to a safe place. As quickly as he could, he scooped up everything off the sandy floor of his cave, a tiny abalone shell with its mother-of-pearl iridescence, bright blue and green pieces of sea glass, several unusual items he had found in sunken boats, and his favorite possession of all, the incredible big giant maker, as he called it, which he had found last summer at the shipwreck at the edge of the lagoon where he lived. Whoever or whatever had made the big giant maker must have been a genius. It was round, sort of like his head, and about the same size. It had a handle, which made it easy for him to pick up. It was made of something you could see through, and that's where the amazing part began. When you looked through the round surface, everything got bigger. The first time he picked it up, he'd been so frightened he dropped it, for he suddenly found himself face to face with the largest hermit crab he'd ever seen. Normally, hermit crabs were a delicious treat, but this particular one looked big enough to eat him. When he dropped the object, he realized he was looking at the same hermit crab, but this time it was just a tasty little treat, and so he ate it. From that moment on, he decided that object was his most prized possession and that he would call it the Big Giant Maker because everything became bigger when he looked through it. So Horby set off to find a new home. He swam around the entire area occupied by his family, but every time he spied something that even looked like a nice little cave, there was an octopus already in it. Saddened, he drifted with the tide for a while, always keeping his eye out for an unwary fish. With the tentacles that weren't holding on to his possessions, Horby snatched them up as quickly as he could and made quite a tasty meal out of them. Before he knew it, stomach full, drifting with the tide, he fell asleep. He had no idea what woke him up. He became startled because the tide had turned, and he found himself in deep water. Now, for an octopus, this is not a good thing, for there are many large fish that consider an octopus quite a tasty treat. Horby was terrified. He knew he had to get back to shallow water as quickly as possible. Worse still, while he was sleeping, he had lost all his prized possessions. So, rather than swim directly for the shore, Horby dove down to the sandy bottom in hopes of finding his treasures. He couldn't stand to think that he might have lost his big giant maker. If he'd had legs instead of tentacles, he would have kicked himself. But since he didn't, he drifted sadly along the bottom, searching in vain for his possessions. He looked everywhere, swimming one way and then another, circling around again. Nothing looked familiar. He must have drifted far away from his old home. He decided to swim even farther out and circled around again, skimming along the sandy bottom, carefully staying away from any caves or big rocks that might hide anything that would like to eat him. Finally, he saw some shiny objects shimmering in the watery light. There they were, and there in the middle of them was the big giant maker. With a sigh of relief, he reached down, gently picked up his most prized possession, and held it as close to his body as he could. He could always replace the shells and sea glass, but not this. Horby turned and started to rise off the sandy bottom. To his horror, a giant moray eel was swimming directly toward him. Eels like nothing better than eating a scrumptious young octopus, but they have trouble finding their favorite treats because octopi are so good at hiding in their caves. Out here in the open waters, Horby knew that, most likely, he was about to be lunch. He might be able to outswim the eel for a while. Maybe he could shoot out some black ink to cover his trail,
but he'd be in trouble if he couldn't make it back to the coral reefs. Horby did the only thing he could think of. He turned his back on that ugly eel, shot a stream of black ink into the water, and sped through the ocean as fast as he could toward shore. He would be safe in shallow water. He clutched the big giant maker in one tentacle. He couldn't bear to part with it. He could see the rocks were definitely getting closer. Horby took a peek behind him, and there, emerging from the remains of the ink, was the giant eel. With unbelievable speed, it slithered through the water. Giving a frightened cry, Horby turned toward shore. He swam as fast as his little tentacles could propel him, blasting water through the siphons on each side of his head, but he could almost hear the eel's sharp teeth getting ready to clamp down on him. Horby couldn't bear to be caught from behind and sucked into that big mouth. At the last instant, he turned to face his attacker and thrust forward the only defense he had, the big giant maker. His only thought was that maybe the eel would grab that first. He didn't realize that the eel didn't see the object either. It did the same thing Horby had done when he first picked it up. It looked through the clear round center and saw the largest octopus eye it had ever seen. Shocked, it backed off for just a second, but that was all Horby needed. With a little cry, he squirted more ink and darted toward shore and into the coral reef and the safety of the first cave he found. It was hours later that Horby finally dared peek out of his hiding spot. Checking carefully, he ventured out of his cave. He wasn't anywhere near his familiar beach. The tides had swept him all the way to another place entirely. He swam slowly through the shallow waters of this new inlet. Giant rocks hunched everywhere, and many little fish were darting about. It was quite a lovely location, he thought. It looked like it might even be a great place to live. He swam slowly around a large rocky mound rising up from the bottom of the ocean. He saw a cave, a nice large one, and not another octopus in sight. He swam by that cave and found another and yet another. Everything seemed perfect. He could have his pick of homes. But what about Uncle Vellini and all the other big octopi that would surely move in if he fixed it up? No, thought Horby, not this time. In fact, never again. I'm going to make sure this new home is protected from all intruders, be they octopi or anything else that might like to eat me. So Horby spent the rest of the day peeking through every possible nook and cranny around the big rock until he found the perfect cave. Not too big, not too little, with currents of water streaming by that would surely bring whole schools of fish his way for dinner. It had a small entrance, and once he was inside, a beautiful sandy bottom where he could store his treasures. The best part, there was a tiny crack in the ceiling, and light from above shone onto the sandy floor. Wouldn't his treasures glisten with the light shining on them? I think I shall call this my Octopus Palace, he said to himself. I will live safely here forever. And he had a secret weapon. If an eel could be startled by the big giant maker, then any respectable octopus would beat a hasty retreat. All he had to do was set it in the entrance to the cave and put something terrifying right behind it. Anyone drifting by who might spy his cave would look in and see, well, what horrible thing would he select? He thought furiously about that. The answer was simple. It was himself, but bigger. Nobody was going to mess with an octopus the size of a whale. Horby set up his big giant maker carefully at the cave's entrance, and every night when he went to sleep, or during the day when he drifted back in after scouring the sandy floors of his new inlet for shiny objects, he positioned the lens right in front of the cave and then, very carefully, placed one of his tiny tentacles on it. No one bothered him ever again. Occasionally, another octopus would swim by, seeking cover. They never stopped to harass Horby, though. Yes, he was little, but those tentacles in front of the big giant maker made him look gigantic. Horby spent his remaining days in his octopus palace, and his shiny collection grew to enormous proportions. During the day, the sun would shine through the little crack in the ceiling of his cave, making everything glitter like diamonds. It is said that, to this day, the inlet where Horby built his palace shines brighter than anywhere else in the ocean. This next story I'm going to relate is a Samoan legend, which many say is true. After hearing the ending, you can decide for yourself. Here is The Legend of the Turtle and the Shark. Fonuea was an old blind woman of western Samoa. Her only child was a girl she named Salofa. A great famine spread all over the villages around them. Starvation was upon western Samoa. One day, the family of Fonuea and Salofa engaged themselves in baking yams, which were gathered from the forest the day before. Fonuea, with the help of her daughter, followed up the progress of the cooking from a distance where they lived. When the smoke disappeared, Fonuea figured that the stones were then heated and that the food was then covered for steaming. Fonuea waited for about 2 hours when she asked Salofa if she could see anybody coming to them with some food. The answer was no. For hours, Fonuea continued the same question, and Salofa repeated the same answer. Fonuea was soon convinced that their family had left them to die starving. After all patience was exhausted, Fonuea ordered her daughter to lead her to the cliff over the ocean. Fonuea, at the edge of the cliff, held her daughter's hand tightly and ordered her to accompany her as they jumped into the ocean. The hungry and distressed mother and child immediately turned into a turtle and a shark. From there, they swam eastward so to be away from their unkind relatives and village. They swam hundreds of miles away until they reached Vaitogi, a village in the island of Tutuia. At the sandy beach in front of the village, they transformed themselves again and became human in order to meet High Chief Letuli and his people. Letuli courteously received his guests and treated them with the best of food and clothing in his guest house. Fonuea and Salofa soon regained their normal strength, which they had lost during the famine and swimming in the ocean for hundreds of miles. In order to show their great appreciation of Latuli's hospitality and cordial reception, Fonuea approached the High Chief Letuli and expressed her sincere gratitude, in which she vowed to the chief that she and her daughter would return to the ocean and lived just below the Vaitogi cliff. "It is there," she continued, "that we would come to the water's surface and dance to entertain you." Fonuea then recited to Letuli a chant, which, when sung, would immediately make them appear. Letuli expressed his great appreciation of the honor bestowed upon him. He immediately proclaimed to the people of Vaitogi that it was a serious offense to destroy, disturb, or to disrespect his guests, the turtle and shark, when they would appear at the bottom of the cliff. Fonuea and her daughter returned to live in the sea in the forms of a turtle and shark. They have lived there for several centuries and never failed once to appear, as they promised, when Letuli's chant was sung over the cliff. The chant goes something like this. Fonuea, O Fonuea, present to me the lovely pair. Who are they that are up there? They are the Letulis everywhere. At rain or at sunshine, the crowd will march in line to view the fishes as they shine. After this chant, the turtle and shark always appear on the surface of the water at the bottom of the cliff. The crowd above calls out, "La lei lei," which means beautiful, 3 times. The villagers warn guests that it is not allowed to point at the turtle and the shark. Pointing fingers would remind them of their troubles of the past in far-off western Samoa. To the turtle and the shark, it is an insult to be reminded of the inhumane treatment they received from their own relatives and village across the ocean. A pointed finger would make the turtle and shark disappear at once. The village guides always inform the visitors to the cliff beforehand about the restriction on pointing of fingers at the turtle and shark. It may sound too good to be true, but the scene at the Vaitogi cliff is one of the great wonders of the world. Scientists have yet to find out why the turtle and shark never appear to the surface unless Letuli's chant is sung. It is as much a mystery to the foreigners as it is to the Samoans, who have tried for several generations to attract the turtle and shark to the surface by other means, but always failed. Best of brass bands played, and large choirs sang the best of anthems, hymns, and island songs over the cliff, but they were all disappointed. Seeing the turtle and shark tops the tourist's attraction in American Samoa today. People say it signifies Fonua's sincere love and appreciation for the villagers who took her and her starving daughter in and gave them food and protection. The last story is about a puffer fish. These fish have the ability to grow to 3 or 4 times their normal size by puffing up when they are in danger. However, as you'll see in the following story, every once in a while a puffer fish has real problems with this unique ability. Here is The Lonely Puffer Fish by E.G. French. This was a beautiful reef with fantail coral, brain corals, fish of every shape and size, and so many of them, everything a puffer fish could want. Dilly was thrilled and excited at the same time. He just knew it would be perfect. True, he hadn't been very successful at making friends at the old reef, but his parents told him this would be a fine place to make a fresh start. He swam around a very large coral head and saw a school of bright yellow fish with black stripes. "How beautiful you are! Can I play with you?" The little school turned as one to look at him and then darted off so fast he couldn't possibly have caught him. Dilly looked around and saw that everyone had swum away. Well, not surprising. What was wrong with him? Every time he became excited about anything, he puffed up into a giant ball with sticky protrusions that looked like thorns. He puffed up so big that his fins could barely allow him to swim, but float he could, and did, for at least 5 minutes while he waited for his body to unpuff. He knew all about the stupid game of puffer ball. That was the game the other fish, particularly those with long snouts, loved to play with his kind. It wasn't much fun. They'd come up behind, poke hard, and of course, puffer fish puff up when they're threatened and scared. As they became large balls, the other fish would bounce them around in the water until they grew tired of the game and swam away. But his puffer friends had learned to unpuff as they grew older. Not Dilly, though. Instead, his body just started reacting to anything strange and new by puffing up. It had happened again, as it always did. With a cry of dismay, he waved his fins, which were now surprisingly small compared to the rest of his body, and moved slowly up and down in the water. Really, this whole thing about being a puffer fish was getting ridiculous. Depressed, he swam back to the little cave his parents had set up as their new home. He looked at them with his sad puffer fish eyes and simply said, "Well, it happened again. I think it's just hopeless." And he cried. Of course, no one can see a fish cry because they are in water, but cry Dilly did for quite a long time. His parents became quite distressed. They looked at each other with despair. Their poor son seemed so sad and lonely. How could he make friends if he scared everyone off before they had a chance to know him? And what about his prospects for meeting a nice lady puffer fish and having children? Life went on for Dilly in much the same fashion as it had before. He'd eagerly swim out in the morning, drift around the reef, trying very hard to stay calm. But the moment he saw anybody coming near, he'd grow excited, and then, of course, he would puff up to an impossible size and scare everyone away. Then, one morning, everything changed. He was swimming around the middle of the reef when he heard a cry from somewhere below him. "Can somebody help me, please?" He peered down through the clear water, but couldn't see anything. Since no other fish were near, he drifted down to investigate. There wasn't anything he could see, but wait! There in the coral between the rocks, he spied a tail, and a very pretty tail it was, with shiny scales that looked silvery in the shimmery water. "Help me, please. Can you just push me a little bit? I'm sure I can squeeze out of here if you can." Dilly was thrilled that somebody was asking for his help. He felt himself puffing up a bit, but forced his body toward the fish tail stuck between the coral and the rocks. "What kind of fish is it?" he wondered. With all his might, he pushed his body against the fish's tail, and pop! Before he knew it, he had pushed the fish right through the crack. "Oh, thank you," cried the fish. While he couldn't see her, he could tell by her voice that it was a girl. But what did she look like? She was on the other side of the coral now, so, curious, he started to swim around to the other side to get a better look. "No, no, please wait. I need to calm down before you see me. Give me a second here. Okay. Okay, you can come round now." Dilly swam around and saw before him a perfectly beautiful pufferfish, just like me, he thought. Thank you so much, she cried. I was being chased by an eel, and when I got into that crack where I was safe, I was so scared I puffed up and got stuck. The little pufferfish fussed with herself, moving her tail and fins back and forth to make sure everything was working properly before continuing. But I'm forgetting my manners. Please forgive me. My name is Eppy, and you are? She looked at him in expectation. Dilly wasn't used to anyone staying around long enough to speak to, much less anybody wanting to ask him his name. It's Dilly, he finally gasped, and of course he became so excited that he started to puff up. You're funny, Eppy said. You're puffing up, you know, and there's only me here. Don't tell me you're afraid of little old me. Laughing hilariously, she rolled over until her belly was facing the sky. No, not at all. It's just that, and Dilly stumbled a bit. I'm just not used to talking to anyone. Oh, dear, I'm starting to puff up again. He saw Eppy turn as if to swim away. Please don't go. I'm not afraid. I just puff up when I get excited and, oh, please wait until I calm down. Please stay. Eppy rolled back over and looked at him curiously. That is a problem. Say, I have an idea. Why don't you think of something really boring when you get excited like that? It might calm you down. Like what? Asked Dilly. Well, the most boring thing I can think of would be a sea cucumber, said Eppy. They don't move much. They're just, well, on the bottom of the ocean, looking rather boring. You know, that's an amazing idea, said Dilly. Sea cucumber, sea cucumber, sea cucumber. And before he knew it, Dilly had shrunk back down, looking completely normal again. My goodness, it works! And in his excitement, he, of course, started to puff right back up again. Sea cucumber, cried Eppy. Think about the sea cucumber. And Dilly did think about a sea cucumber and unpuffed again. And so that was the beginning of their friendship, which eventually grew into love and ultimately, as these things have a way of going, into marriage. Dilly's parents were overjoyed. Eppy had shown him what to do, and it was so simple. Whenever Dilly got excited, everyone near him would call out, "Sea cucumber! Sea cucumber!" Pretty soon, Dilly was able to control his puffiness within seconds. Eventually, Dilly and Eppy had many little pufferfish children, and you always knew when they were near because inevitably, when Dilly saw something exciting, their little voices cried, "Sea cucumber, Daddy! Sea cucumber!" A whole school of little fish calling out sea cucumber was an unusual thing in the ocean. The oddest thing happened. Sea cucumbers became quite popular, and many fish would choose to spend time around them, curious about why so many pufferfish were calling out their name. Little did they know the real reason. And of course, sea cucumbers were just pleased that someone had finally noticed them. So we've come to the end of our time together today. If you have a story you'd like to hear, please feel free to write me with your request. If you've written a children's story and would like to share it, let me know as well. I welcome your feedback. You can email me at guima@kciw.org. That's guima@kciw.org. See you next week, same time, same place, but very different stories. We'll be traveling to Scandinavia, land of ice, snow, Vikings, and reindeer. Stay safe, have fun, and let your imagination soar. This is Guima saying goodbye and happy reading. This has been a production of KCIW LP 100.7 FM in Brookings, Oregon.